National news from a grassroots perspective. You're listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast.
But I also think it's just a bit of the tip of the iceberg on the issue of kind of systemic barriers and the unfriendliness that mothers encounter daily because they have children.
Construction of a pipeline will cross hundreds of tributaries and these rivers themselves. It's not if an accident's going to happen, it's a matter of when.
We began to say that homelessness was not the result of economic, social, structural, political issues, but it was because people were making choices to be homeless. They were lazy, they were crazy, or they were stupid.
Hello and welcome to Groundwire. This is Anchor Kumar. Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus Community Radio Association. Today on the ground, a victory for a breastfeeding mom in Newmarket, Ontario. We'll also hear about Enbridge's new Northern Gateway pipeline proposal and how it violates the rights on the Wet'suwet'en First Nation. An in-depth look at the militarization of Haiti and their efforts to rebuild following the devastating earthquake that took place on January 12th. All this plus a special feature from Ryerson University's media production program on homelessness in Toronto, Ontario's Allen Park. That's all coming up on this edition of Groundwire, but first, here's Cameron Doig with the headlines.
Thousands across Canada rallied Saturday, January 23rd, in opposition to the recent prorogation of Parliament by Stephen Harper and his Conservative government. Paul Chislett and Matt Weingarten of CJAM report from the rally held in Windsor, Ontario, a city known for its strong ties to the labour movement.
Because it's no, nay, never.
Stephen Harper!
No, nay, never, no more. Will you play the proroger? Nay, never.
I'm here to highlight the proroguing of Parliament at a time when there were many important issues on the table that should have been dealt with, but that the Harper government has decided to walk away from due to potential embarrassment.
Ron Bertram is the political action chair for the Windsor District Labour Council and a labour activist in the city of Windsor. Bertram and several hundred others rallied as part of a national protest against the prorogation of Parliament by Stephen Harper's Conservative government.
And they call it democracy.
Prorogation is a procedural tool used by prime ministers. However, what is rankling Canadians this time is there are many questions to be answered around the Afghan detainee issue that Mr. Harper wants to avoid, and he can appoint more Conservatives to the Senate. In a city known for its strong ties to labor, this rally also united political activists and proponents of the arts.
Kieran McKenzie is a spokesperson for Windsor West MP Brian Massey.
I'm here to stand up for democracy, to try to let our Prime Minister, Mr. Harper, know that this politically motivated prorogation is outrageous.
Brock Easton, a Liberal and former president of the Conservative Party of Canada, was quite vocal about his disdain for the Stephen Harper Conservatives and their policies.
We don't need our MPs sitting at home on their hands. We need our Parliament working. This man should be able to take some criticism, but when a bureaucrat steps up and says we've got problems with the Afghan detainees, the whole government denounces that bureaucrat who's standing up telling the truth.
Michelle Manwaring, a performance artist, helped organize the rally.
I really did educate myself once I found out about what proroguing meant, and I have gone from apathy to activism, and it feels great.
Mark MacArthur is a member of the Canadian Union of Public Employees.
I'm offended that this government thinks they have the authority to just abandon our democratic principles and not hold a parliament.
There you go. Yep.
Gary Parent is former president of the Windsor and District Labour Council.
Actually, we're here to send a loud, clear message to Mr. Harper and the Conservative government. They don't have the right to paralyze parliament the way that they've done twice now within inside of 12 months.
What do you feel the real reason for this prorogation is?
He's running away. He can run, but he can't hide. Eventually, he's going to be held accountable. And this is our message right across this country today to explain to him and his cabinet and all the members of the general public, Parliament means too much to Canadians to have it hijacked by the Prime Minister.
Produced by Paul Chislett
and Matt Weingarten for Groundwire and CJAM Windsor.
After a year-long wait, a Newmarket pool owner recently settled with a mother who filed a complaint with the Ontario Human Rights Commission after she was kicked out for breastfeeding her child in public, CHRY in Toronto reports.
After breastfeeding mother Sinira Lungu-Winho was asked to stop breastfeeding in the Aqua Centre pool in Newmarket, Ontario on October 24, 2008, she organized a peaceful nurse-in that was met with security guards in bulletproof vests. When Ms. Lungu-Winho did not receive an apology from the pool owner, she filed a claim with the Ontario Human Rights Commission. After over a year of waiting, the case was settled this month. The pool owner not only apologized, but also agreed to make a $2,000 donation to a woman's shelter and post signs saying that breastfeeding is allowed in and around the pool. As part of the settlement, Ms. Longuinho insisted that the settlement terms be made public to encourage mothers who might be uncomfortable breastfeeding in public. Pat Breton is a PhD student in women's studies at York University, a mother, and is researching single mothering. She comments on the systemic barriers that mothers face.
But I also think it's just a bit of the tip of the iceberg on the issue of kind of systemic barriers and the, quote, unfriendliness, quote, unquote, that mothers encounter daily because they have children. So really, we're not, as I said, a positive, mother-positive, child-friendly society. And in my own area of research in mothering and single mothering, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but statistically in Canada, single mothers are the poorest of the poor. And within that category, it's Aboriginal mothers are the poorest. So, you know, if we look at the larger issues, such as lack of universal affordable daycare, we're also talking about having affordable housing for the mothers. And also, you know, what are the barriers that racialized mothers are facing today?
Even more frustrating is that the incident in Newmarket occurred in the middle of York Region's Anytime, Anywhere breastfeeding campaign. This incident is not isolated, as cases of discrimination have been reported at pools and fitness centers across the country. In the 1990s, the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal ruled that a child can nurse anywhere her mother is legally permitted to be. The pool owner in the Newmarket case and a similar case in Hamilton in 2001 claimed that the no food or drink allowed in the pool rule should apply to breastfeeding mothers as well. The Hamilton case was settled in favor of the breastfeeding mother in a discrimination suit against the city of Hamilton, and the entire city was forced to adopt new policies at its pool. Reporting for Groundwire, this is Ome Sama Rahamthula for CHRY in Toronto.
The Wet'suwet'en First Nation is leading the opposition to Ironbridge's proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline. The pipeline would link the oil sands in northern Alberta to an oil tanker port in Kitimat, British Columbia, and infringes on Aboriginal rights and title. Craig Paulson of CICK, Smithers Community Radio, reports.
I'm David DeWitt, Natural Resources Manager for the Office of the Wet'suwet'en.
David, what is the proposed Enbridge pipeline project?
The proposed Northern Gateway project by Enbridge is a twin pipeline that is proposed to run from Bruderheim, Alberta, to Kitimat, British Columbia.
How will the proposed pipeline impact the Wet'suwet'en?
The Wet'suwet'en culture, our traditions, our trade and commerce are based on salmon. Construction of a pipeline will cross hundreds of tributaries and these water or these rivers themselves. It's not if an accident's going to happen with a pipeline or tanker. It's a matter of when. These impacts will be spread farther down, not only to the Wet'suwet'en, but other First Nations and non-First Nation communities downstream from the Maurice or Wet'suwet'en River. We can't see how the proposed Enbridge pipeline project can move forward without infringing on the Wet'suwet'en's right to sustain themselves or their right of governance to support their trade and their economies. We're not moving, and we need solutions for our children's children and the next generations.
My name is Tsikwot. I'm from the House of Kinaylayah, Lhasilu Clan. My English name is Ron Austin.
What do you anticipate the impacts of the proposed project will be?
I feel that, first of all, our brothers, the Cree in Alberta, are suffering from the fallout of the tar sands and also the wildlife. And then when it gets into our territory, if a pipeline goes through, they have to realize that it is our territory that it's going through. And if there is a spill of any sort, the ecological damage will also affect our people, our wildlife, our plants.
We're speaking with Nikki Skous, Senior Energy Campaigner for Forest Ethics. Nikki, we've heard from the Office of the Wet'suwet'en about the impacts of the proposed pipeline on their resources and how the project process infringes on their Aboriginal rights and title. What can concerned citizens across Canada do about this project?
Well, people can tell Enbridge, in particular, that they are opposed to this project, that they stand with First Nations. And in particular, if they are natural gas customers in Ontario, they can do so just when they pay their bill or just call and let Enbridge know that they don't want their gas company linked with this dirty oil project. They can also tell their member of parliament that they support a permanent tanker ban on BC's north coast, and that will effectively help stop this project in its tracks.
To learn more, visit www.wet'suwet'en.com. This is CICK Smithers Community Radio.
For this episode's Community Radio Report, Cam Wells talks to Melanie Grant about a new FM station in Truro, Nova Scotia, and about the unique programming that they will bring to the community.
The recent CRTC hearings have had a lot of impact in the radio community, including the final decision to go ahead and establish a station in Truro, Nova Scotia. Melanie Grant of the station expressed enthusiasm for the project.
Our programming is a little bit different than some of the community stations that I know about anyway. Our whole focus is local music, local talent, and local events. So because we have a low frequency, it's just our little tiny town of about 11,000 people, and our core focus is going to be showcasing our local talent. So we have, like most of Nova Scotia, our town is filled with a rich culture of local musicians, everything from folk to fiddle to pipe and drum bands, church choirs. There's a hard rock scene here, and then, of course, the local bands that play in the bars. There's a really amazing musical culture.
Though the station has now been approved, it was a long process getting there.
Regulations that you have to go to, there's municipal, federal, and provincial, all rules need to be met. So actually filling out the application and sending it in took about 8 months. And then the CRTC takes a little bit of time to process this sort of information, and so that took about six months to do. And then we had another application to send in, as the frequency that we chose wasn't acceptable, so we had to fill in a whole new application, send that in with a new frequency choice. So they just got back to us the day before yesterday letting us know that the frequency that we had chosen was acceptable with both them and Industry Canada, so now we have the go-ahead.
For Groundwire, Cam Wells reporting.
Thanks to Cam Wells for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. Groundwire will be back after Union Burying Ground, a song by Windsor singer-songwriter Travis Rietsma. Welcome back to Groundwire, a bi-weekly non-profit national news program produced by the community for the community. Groundwire is heard on dozens of community radio stations across Canada. And now for our feature stories. 25,000 soldiers are far outnumbering doctors in Haiti. In the wake of a level 7 earthquake, the level of militarization is disquieting to several of Haiti's neighbors. CKUT's Chris Scott and Courtney Kirkby take an extended look at Haiti and explore competing visions of the North and South Bloc hold for Haiti's future.
What do you think is going to happen now?
What can happen? Haiti is finished. There's nothing left. There's nothing left. Brutalité sans réparation, projet de
l'ascension. Attention. Port-au-Prince resident Margaret Barnett speaks to journalist Ansel Hertz on the morning after Haiti's devastating earthquake. In raw tone, she recounts her personal losses, and she also evokes the cynicism many Haitians now feel toward the international community.
No, but the only thing I don't understand, the United Nations, is it really here to help, or what is it doing? Because I live in Tabasi, these people standing in their place, they didn't move. What's going to happen? What kind of help? There's no hospital. Like, everybody talking about Haiti. The Americans are saying Haiti this, Haiti that. Is it true the American really helped the Haitian people? There's no help.
At the time of the earthquake, Haiti was patrolled by a force of 9,000 UN soldiers. Thousands of NGOs and international aid agencies dotted Haiti's landscape. Yet few of these personnel seemed to be on hand to assist Haitians in the hours and days following the disaster. Ansel Hertz explains.
I have seen only one instance of large-scale aid being distributed from a UN truck since the earthquake. And I've been traveling around the city by motorcycle all around the city for the past almost a week now since the earthquake. In the first 3 days, the first two or three days after the earthquake, I saw not a single rescue team. And so it nobody from the Dominican Republic, nobody from the United States, not a single rescue team, only Haitians helping each other.
Haitians are a proud people who have survived a history of multiple foreign interventions. These interventions have served to weaken or realign the nation's economy along neoliberal lines. In 2004, soldiers from the U.S., Canada, and France facilitated the overthrow of Haiti's popular government. 25,000 soldiers are now largely shaping the international relief efforts, and this leaves Haitians apprehensive that the large military presence may outstay its welcome.
Nous sommes venus ici aujourd'hui pour apporter notre solidarité.
In Montreal, outside a conference of donor nations focused on Haiti's reconstruction, Haitian expatriate Serge Beauchareau addresses a crowd.
This catastrophe must not serve as a pretext to abuse Haitian sovereignty. We have fought and shed our blood to have this piece of land for ourselves. We don't want this nightmare to be used to steal our country, to make us a star on the American flag, or an associated state like Puerto Rico. Haiti must belong to the Haitians. Haiti for the Haitians.
At a demonstration organized by Canada Haiti Action Network, CKUT spoke with protester Anthony Morgan. He warned that interests of foreign companies managing reconstruction may be at odds with those of average Haitians.
And why am I here? There's a number of reasons why I'm here. And I'd say the first is wanting demilitarization of aid. Right? I think there needs to be more priority put on having doctors, not soldiers, medicine, not guns in the country. Right? I think it's been disproportionate, the amount of troops that have been put on the ground. Certainly a degree of security needs to be set in the country. However, denying planes because there's military men on the ground, it doesn't accord with me. If they're going to be talking about reconstruction, I think these foreign powers need to seriously own up to their responsibility in the underdevelopment of Haiti, right? The embargoes that have been laid on Haiti for years, also just the debt that Haiti had to pay for liberating itself. It was absolutely unheard of in 1820 and 1825 when they were forced by France to pay 150 million gold francs. Right, they didn't end up paying that off until 1947. In terms of having to pay that off over the years, Haiti was paying out approximately 90% of its budget. You can't ask any person, any home, to run itself, giving away 90% of its funds to other people. It's just unfathomable. So I think it's critically important that they discuss canceling absolutely all debt of the country, and having all the aid that's been given, it be grants and absolutely no more loans.
Although Haiti covers a tiny land area and has a small population, the significance of this country has long resonated far beyond its borders. Haiti was born out of a slave revolt in 1804. The Republic was ostracized by European powers, but forged close links with its neighbors in the Caribbean. Starting in the 1980s, Haiti's popular movement inspired the anti-neoliberal agenda, which has since gained prominence in the Caribbean. Protester Mary Pierre questions the absence of leaders of the country's neighboring Haiti at the Montreal Reconstruction Conference.
Nous sommes toujours d'accord pour que eux ils nous aident en Haïti, mais nous ne sommes pas d'accord sur l'occupation.
We agree that they can help us in Haiti, but we don't agree with an occupation. And we also disagree because they haven't included Caribbean leaders like Fidel Castro, Chavez, and all the others.
On the day before the Montreal conference, South American leaders held their own meeting in Caracas, Venezuela. They announced a relief plan for Haiti premised on humanitarian aid and debt forgiveness. Talks in Montreal had a different focus. Professor Peter Hallward discusses the contradiction between Haiti's popular movement and the free trade agenda.
The popular movement became known as La Valas. It generates a momentum that the army and the paramilitaries and so on can't really contain. And they finally win an election in 1990 that brings Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power with a great deal of momentum and political power behind it. And it's in response to that a whole series of steps are taken to basically make sure that this doesn't happen, to preserve the interests of small social and economic elite in Haiti and the interests of their interlocutors in the international community. And that takes initially the form of a military coup that overthrows that government, as you know, in 1991. And then it takes on a different shape when Aristide is re-elected in 2000. The strategy to weaken this movement and to undercut the government took on a more elaborate form. But broadly speaking, it's an extension of some of the fundamental neoliberal policies that involve cutting public spending, privatizing state resources, pushing through various austerity measures.
I think we've seen since 2004 the majority of Canadian aid has been earmarked to projects that involve security, reinforcing the police, reinforcing the judicial apparatus, and much less money has been targeted to projects such as roads or improving roads or hospitals.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's possibly the single most important issue is how it was that political questions about the empowerment of the majority of the people, about justice, about equality, were basically deflected and replaced by questions around security, the security of property, security of privilege. You can see it at so many levels in what's going on in the response to the earthquake. You know, flight after flight with humanitarian aid or humanitarian equipment is turned away in favor of bringing more and more U.S. soldiers in. And what this means, by saying we have to wait till the situation is secure, means that we will let these people die, rather than try and save probably the thousands of people that could have been saved in the initial days of this disaster. Rather than do that, the priority has been taken very calmly, very deliberately, to let them die, and instead to make a priority of establishing, you know, international military control over a few zones of Port-au-Prince before they begin the process of distributing aid. The spokesman people for the Doctors Without Borders are so outraged now, you know, saying that they've never seen anything like it, that a kind of callousness and this the perversity of this insistence on an agenda driven by, you know, basically by the paranoid security agenda of the international troops rather than the immediate and overwhelming needs of the Haitian people themselves.
This Groundwire report was produced by Courtney Kirkby and Chris Scott in Montreal. Special thanks to Ansel Hertz in Port-au-Prince. To view Ansel's reporting online, you can visit www.mediahacker.org.
Toronto, Ontario's Allen Park has become a space where the city's homeless population gathers to sleep at night. Students of Ryerson University's media production program have recorded the following feature about the complexity of homelessness, why the media's coverage of this social issue is problematic, and how we can overcome these stereotypes.
As we walked into Allen Gardens Park for the very first time, we were confronted with issues of poverty, homelessness, and substance abuse.
George Allen was the owner, and he donated a parcel of land. At that time, it was 5 acres back in the mid-1800s. And it was donated to the Toronto Horticultural Society.
It doesn't matter what part of the city you come from, everyone's always looking for a respite from the noises and the busyness of the city, so it's just kind of a nice place to be able to come and relax.
Beautiful trees, there's the massive greenhouse, it's stunning. I'd like to picnic and actually use the park, but I don't. I feel like the park is not that usable to the average person. Certainly, most people would not take their family to this park. They would choose other parks.
I think that, you know, when the sun goes down, the lights go on, it's kind of best to go in there or get out of the park anyway. So.
In this economic environment, so many people are out of work and lost their families that they do end up at one of the homeless shelters a lot of the time, and they make their way into the gardens, and this is a bit of a sanctuary for them.
The City of Toronto says that there's about close to 4,000 people who sleep every night in homeless shelters. That's women, men, and children. In addition to that, the city says there's another few thousand people who are what's called sleeping rough. That's living in parks, under bridges, and that sort of thing. There are homeless people who are staying temporarily as guests of the government in jails. A lot of homeless people end up in jail. Probably a few hundred every month are in
people
local
sleep
jails
there.
And hospitals.
They sleep there at night. And that's something that, you know, the city just closes their eyes on.
Basic level, people need homes. You know, try to find a place in Toronto that's even under $500 right? You're going to be out of luck unless you're sharing, you know, a rooming house, perhaps even. And perhaps even then, you might be out of luck as well. What it means to be homeless is huge, and we don't think about that. What a lot of people think about is that the person they see on the street, you know, the rough sleeper, which actually is a small percentage of people that are homeless.
Lots of drugs in the area, lots of criminals. But that's outside.
But I don't think they come into the dog area. But mostly they stay out on the benches, and they all seem to know each other. Never had any problems with anybody. Everybody seems to be very cool here.
There became this pathologizing, and so all of a sudden we began to say that homelessness was not the result of economic, social, structural, political issues, but it was because people were making choices to be homeless. They were lazy, they were crazy, or they were stupid.
I think it's been too easy too often for the media to dismiss people that it's an individual choice to live on the street. Who really wants to live on the street is my question. But the reality is that people want security, people want safety, people want affordability, all those sort of things. And when we present homelessness in a way that puts it into this really strange light as if it was somebody's individual choice to be in that situation, then we really do a disservice to those the people that are experiencing homelessness and also to ourselves as a society.
Whenever the media want an image of homelessness, they run down to Queen and Victoria Streets by St. Michael's Hospital and take a picture or video of a person sleeping on a grate begging for a handout. Such a one-dimensional image causes the viewer to feel revulsion or pity.
And, you know, and for me, I asked her to move. It was really, really heartbreaking in the middle of winter. And I didn't want to bring her into my home. I don't know who she is, but... So I gave her $20 and I said, please, make sure you go and find the place to go. You know, she said, I can't go to Street Haven anymore. They throw us out. So these women are vulnerable. Where does she go? She goes over in Seton House, where the men attack you and you know, take whatever you have, but where else can she go?
Part of it is hearing people's stories thoroughly in terms of what they're experiencing and not representing homelessness as just the people you see sleeping out on the streets. What does a homeless person look like? And the reality is you have no idea.
These sort of perceptions and stereotypes go beyond the media. They're deeply embedded in the North American culture is this notion, this fundamental notion, if you work hard and you keep your nose clean, you're going to prosper. And if you don't, you're going to get your comeuppance. That if you do the crime, then you have to do the time.
We have a lot of political will around a lot of various things. We squandered $1 billion towards e-health. We've put $18 billion a year into military engagement. I mean, when it comes down to it, the political will is there for certain things. Why is it not about protecting and taking care of our own citizens adequately?
People fall through the cracks for different reasons. It's anybody.
I think we need to be more empathetic, compassionate, and effective in our policies and our attitudes towards people that are experiencing homelessness.
So instead of trying to say to them, you have to figure out how you can live your life in the midst of all these barriers and obstacles that we've created for you, we say, well, actually, it's our problem to figure out how we can create a safe, healthy environment for you.
I say open your heart, have a little more compassion. I'm not saying go out there and, you know, bring one home person home or whatever food. Like, I'm saying tell the government enough is enough. We need more homes.
Thanks to producers Jesse Carell, Ryan Zack, and Brian Colley for this contribution to Groundwire. All of our episodes are available for listening and podcasting at groundwire.ncra.ca. If you're interested in contributing as a journalist, get in touch with us by email at groundwire@ncra.ca. This edition was produced by Josh Combe and Cassandra Caverhill at CJAM in Windsor, Ontario. We thank contributors Paul Chislett, Matthew Weingarten, Omer Rahamtula, Craig Paulson, Cam Wells, Courtney Kirkby, Chris Scott, and the students of Ryerson University's Media Production Class. This has been Anchor Coomer. From all of us at Groundwire, thanks for tuning in.